You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
The system is rigged, and I've been saying it for a long time. But you know what? What happened today, starting with the FBI, maybe the system will become a little less rigged. Beautiful.
Or alternatively, not. Why is the FBI reviving Servergate now while overlooking Donald Trump's connections with Russia in the interests, so they say, of not interfering with the election? My guests Roger Boyes and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including, is Russia as big a threat as the Director General of MI5 says it is? Why aren't either of the US presidential candidates talking about Mosul? And do you want to know how much taxes your friends, colleagues, and neighbours pay? And would you move to Finland to find out? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Roger Boyes, diplomatic editor of The Times, and Michael Goldfarb, the veteran journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. And first tonight, let it not be said that Britain's spooks have an unsatisfactory grip on the obvious. Speaking in a newspaper interview, MI5 Director General Andrew Parker spoke of a recently aggressive approach by Russia in the realms of foreign policy, including such overt manifestations as sailing backfiring flagship the Admiral Kuznetsov through the English Channel, and more covert ones, such as cyber attacks and more old-fashioned espionage. The Kremlin, as is traditional, denies everything. Roger, first of all, has there been any point in the last, I don't know, couple of centuries during which you couldn't have said the same of Russia?
Well, yeah, barring the cyber stuff.
That is a new development, in fairness.
And frankly, you know, there's utterly no surprises in this MI5, outing. It's when they come out of the shadows, you know, to use the cliche, there's usually a purpose, and the purpose in this case is the Investigative Powers Act, which is going through the Lords at the moment, and he feels he needs to justify it in PR terms. So he went to The Guardian, which is the most skeptical of the papers about surveillance, and that's what he's done. And then he's tried to justify surveillance on the basis of Islamic State, Russia, and anything else he can think of. And it's all very, very familiar. It's, I wouldn't say it's a waste of space. It's always useful to know, you know, that he's, you know, that the head of MI5 is a tall bloke, which I think is the nearest to news that came out of this piece. You know, I suppose, do people want this kind of reassurance? I don't know. Of course, the objective fact is that Russia is cranking up, that it's got a military adventurist government, and that something is happening down there, and therefore we shouldn't just be thinking about threats from the Islamic State. But you can misread events. The one thing, sorry, I don't mean to ramble on, but the one thing that is interesting is how far, and this has changed over the years, is how far the overlap now between MI5 and MI6 is. So they're very much into analyzing Russian intentions, for example, which used to be the the task of MI6, the external intelligence services. And now there's a very big overlap. He's talking much as a kind of Secret Service head would in the other service. So it might be we're moving in that direction now. We already moved a little bit in the war against terrorism, and now we're moving even more, that they're meshing now.
They could amalgamate them perhaps as MI5 and a half. Michael, how big a threat is Russia though, really, specifically to the UK? I guess what I'm asking is there any danger that this time next year this program will be called Midori Dacha and we'll be discussing it we'll be conducting it in Russian?
And there'll be vodka on the table, I hope, because all we've
as
got
usual,
is water,
obviously.
Man. This is boring. Look, I don't know. This is the thing about all of this, all allegations of cyber espionage. Allegations of espionage anyway are difficult to prove until you drag someone into a courtroom and prove it. But cyber espionage is even more difficult to prove. So it's an allegation. It seems to me that all of the circumstantial evidence points to at least beefing up of Russia's cyber espionage, but also cyber warfare capabilities. One of the interesting things that I read over the weekend in the Financial Times was a look at how the Russian military is about to have its budget cut. There's about to be budget cuts across the board in Russia because the price of oil, its main source of foreign currency and reserves, continues to be depressed, and it's hard for Russia to service its debt. It's entirely possible that you'll see that black smoke belching ship retired and no new ones coming on stream. But, you know, if they possess the capability of posing threat or occupying the thoughts of, I don't think they think of Britain as an enemy, even the United States, but they're competitors. And, you know, the Russians do like to maintain a sense of balance for their own domestic sense of balance. You're right about that when you talk about several centuries of this. Russia always looks west and sees the potential for disaster. And so this is their way of being vigilant. And they do have a capability. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, I do buy into the fact that there's a certain amount of that capability being deployed in the American election at the moment.
On that thought, Roger, that Michael was just discussing there, the idea of Russia's sort of, I guess, slightly fearful, baleful view of towards the West from where it sits. How much overlap do we think there is between what Russia actually wants and what the West, which obviously now goes up to and I guess including its very, very borders with the Baltic states, etc. But where is the overlap between what Russia wants and what the West is willing to let it have?
Well, you'd have to have an extremely long program to go through all of that, because it has different needs and changing needs and changing interests in different parts of the world. But if you took this massive aircraft carrier, for example, that just gone down the English Channel and is presumably on its way to the coast of Syria, then you can read that in two ways. You know, one is that they're about to bomb the hell out of Aleppo, which is the favored explanation of the British. And the other is that it's part of this lame duckism, you know, this Russian policy that we've been seeing for the last 6 months, in recognition that America's not going to do anything at all for quite a long time. And in anticipation of probably of a Hillary Clinton as president, and therefore of perhaps the introduction of a no-fly zone over Syria and Iraq. So it wants to have a deterrent force there to rule out that future option of a future president. And I think that's how you have to think of it. I think Russia is doing a lot of things which it thinks is three steps ahead. So what we see as a direct threat to the current situation is actually them acting sort of defensively or deterrently. I've just been writing about Central Asia. It's exactly the same there. There's a big battle going on between Russia, China, and indeed a little bit of the West to gain influence in all the stands. You know, so there is something going on. There is, in kind of Cold War terms, some kind of global competition going on. The danger is only that this competition tips into an accidental war by some blundering admiral or some breakdown in communications. But it's not, you know, it's not Cold War 2.0 or whatever number we're on now. It's not that. But we are in a situation, in an epoch of new global positioning, all of which contain their dangers, but actually are not a big threat and shouldn't cause us to stay awake at night.
Michael, final thought on this one. Director General Andrew Parker also spoke of Russia's much souped up and much sophisticated new and newish propaganda arms. How big a threat really are the likes of RT? Because aren't they by definition only broadcasting to people who are predisposed to believe them anyway?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think here in the West that they are as nothing. And I mean, it might have helped build Jeremy Corbyn's Q rating so that he could ascend to the leadership of the Labour Party. But first time I saw RT was in Erbil in 7 or 8 years ago. And it was on, you know, you get to that thing in the hotel room where it's CNN, BBC, CCTV, Chinese person, you know, perfect English speaking. That's an interesting perspective on the news. And then RT. And I do wonder if, you know, because English is the lingua franca, the elites of the stands, for example, and of Central Asia and South Asia speak English and they might catch Russia Today. It offers a kind of anti-colonialist view, and it might have some influence there. But honestly, I don't think it has much influence at all. And yeah, I mean, I think that's that kind of old-fashioned propaganda doesn't work. They're probably better off using their spies to, you know, infiltrate the Guardian. I don't know.
Well, on a semi-related note, moving along, Russia is currently enjoying its greatest obvious influence on US politics since the Cold War, because aside from the curiously cozy relationship which appears to exist between the Kremlin and the Republican nominee, Russia also gets a cameo in the latest episode of the saga of Hillary Clinton's email server. As the FBI picked this of all weeks to announce that they'd found yet another thread to pull on, it was also claimed that the FBI had withheld evidence of Russian support for Trump for fear of skewing the election. Roger, Hillary Clinton's team are crying double standard. Do they have a point?
Yeah, I think they do. Something very strange is happening in the FBI, it seems to me, at least, you know, I mean, if you compare this James Comey with Andrew Parker, who both have parallel jobs, it seems to me James Comey is a little bit overexposed at the moment. It wouldn't do him any harm to go back a little bit into the shadows. But it's, they should be staying out. And there's a real problem with this, which is part of this chaotic election campaign has been, you know, the compensating factor of this chaotic election campaign is to say, well, it doesn't matter. We've got our checks and balances, yeah? We've got institutions, and, you know, even if we elect a clown as president, you know, it's okay because we can, you know, we're a mature democracy that knows how to work around this. Well, but if you're getting a federal agency politicized, if you're getting other institutions undermined and basically sucked into this kind of partisan warfare, then it's a wrecking operation. It's like there's rising damp in the building, you know. So that's my main worry. But obviously, it's going to harm Hillary. I mean, Mike's the great expert on this, but it seems to me there's no way around it. We're going to have to ask questions about her judgment. I mean, honestly, why did she still employ Huma? Huma should have been got rid of ages ago, you know, frankly. You know, it's, you know, you just have to mention the name Anthony Weiner to send shudders down everyone's spine.
Michael, is it possible to understand what is going on here? Are the FBI pursuing some sort of agenda? Has somebody just taken leave of their professional decorum and/or senses? Or is, as is very often the case where large bureaucracies are concerned, has something just got screwed up somewhere?
Well, I mean, I'm going to borrow Roger's line about needing several hours to unpick all this. Look, there's a couple of things. One is the immediate question about this Russia connection. You remember that, maybe listeners have forgotten, I hope, well, maybe it's healthy to forget. There was a point in the middle of the campaign where Trump's campaign manager, his second, was called Paul Manafort. And it turned out that he was a PR who had worked doing PR for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the Kremlin's man running the Ukraine, freely elected as any Russian person will say, and he was overthrown in a coup, but maybe not. Popular uprising, I think. And anyway, Manafort had enormous connections back to the Kremlin, and the press back in June and July went out of its way to report on this, and his position was made untenable, and he left. Now, in this case, I do think that some of what we're seeing is organized opposition reporting from, you know, the more liberal mainstream press about this stuff, which has been out there. I mean, we've known for a long time, even before Manafort came on, there were strong indications that Trump's business empire, which totters, I mean, he goes from crisis to crisis as a businessman, is supported by money coming out of Russian banks. And over the weekend, one bank, somebody leaked email traffic between the Trump headquarters and this Russian bank, which spiked in August. What could it be? Well, by the time we figure it out and what it is, the election will be over, so we won't see it. That's part of the answer. The other part is the FBI. The FBI has been politicized almost since its founding. J. Edgar Hoover, went out of his way to pursue, you know, people he thought were against, you know, internal subversives, and organized crime flourished under J. Edgar Hoover. The FBI was set up to get Al Capone, essentially, and he went after Martin Luther King. That's how we know of him, and it's no surprise. And the third thing is that, you know, many people will have forgotten this, but in the summer of 2001, the field office of the FBI in Minnesota was reporting, and in Arizona, on these very strange people from countries that we monitor for radical Islamic activity, turning up in the United States, learning how to fly jumbo jets and not learning how to land them. And somehow coming from those field offices, totally ignored by HQ in Washington. And on September 11th, we saw what happened. The FBI, like many institutions of American government, is old, unchallenged, and in need of serious refreshing in terms of its personnel, and perhaps rededication to its mission. And I think that Comey proves that it is politicized, and whether he intended to bring this up or whether he was trying to get ahead of some, you know, one of his field offices that were going to leak information and he knew about it, and I don't know. And again, the election will be over before we find out the truth.
Roger, just before we go to a break, the feds have said that they haven't found anything linking Trump to Russia's government, but they don't think Russia is trying to elect Trump, just disrupt the election. I mean, briefly, what would possibly be Russia's interest in disrupting the election with no particular thought to the result?
Well, I mean, there is an ideological debate, which is our democracy is better than yours. And there is a tit-for-tat level of that debate, which is you've tried to disrupt our elections, we can disrupt yours. They're terrified of elections. Before the last Duma elections, they were terrified that somehow people would be manipulated onto the streets. Didn't happen, but that's what they were worried about. They'd like to spread the same fear to the United States.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Roger Boyce and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, more progress reported in the battle to recapture Mosul from Islamic State. Why does the US seem to have lost interest?
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I'd like to tell you all about a very special edition of The Foreign Desk coming up next month. For the first time, The Foreign Desk will be recorded live in front of an audience here at Midori House in London. We'll have a fantastic panel of guests, all experts in their field, and we've got a topic that will provide plenty for them to get their teeth into.
It's not about us so much as it is about you and your families and the kind of country and future you want.
Taking place a week after the US presidential vote, we'll ask what the election of President Clinton or President Trump means for the rest of the world.
We are going to enforce all trade violations against any country that cheats.
So we have a topic, we have guests, all that's missing is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to buy your ticket today. That's The Foreign Desk Live with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Tuesday, the 15th of November at 1900.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Roger Boyce and Michael Goldfarb. And as we go to air, Iraqi forces are reported to have entered the eastern suburbs of Mosul. Photos have shown special forces troops in command of the state television building in the city. From the south, Iraq's 9th Division are encountering some resistance from Islamic State guerrillas, but the overall picture is, so far as one can tell from this distance, one of progress towards retrieving Iraq's second largest city from the clutches of IS. It's hard to imagine that anyone outside IS doesn't think this is good news. So why is neither presidential candidate back in the US much talking about it? Michael, are they both just observing the convention that foreign affairs pulls in no voters?
Yeah. but also, I mean, it did come up during two presidential debates and you know, and Trump was saying, oh, we're going to invade Mosul, and we've told them already that we're coming, you know, with his typical ignorance, because this is primarily, most of the troops on the ground are Iraqi special forces and Kurdish Peshmerga. It's true that American special forces are among them, but this is a very, very delicate operation. It can't be seen as America taking back Iraq's second city. It has to be seen as an Iraqi operation. It's far too complicated for even the ordinary well-informed. It's a very relative term in America. I've just come back. I know what I'm talking about. The ordinary American doesn't get it, you know, and they won't until they're really in Mosul. And just to say, Steve, I know that television station well. It is, there's still quite a few hard miles before you get to the Tigris. Essentially, that the television station has always kind of marked a boundary between what was safe Kurdish and Arab Christian villages, and then getting into the more densely packed conurbation that is Mosul. And you know, it's great that they're there, but it's, you know, things are slowing down now. They're pressing down. They're being very deliberate, pressing down from the north towards Bashika. They're pressing up for the south. But the Tigris, it's on the west bank of the Tigris that the real strength of and the real resistance of Daesh, ISIS, will be found. It's a ways away yet, you know, 6-7 miles yet.
Roger, is there any mileage that either Trump or Clinton could have made out of this in terms of their presidential credentials? Could Hillary Clinton have said that the groundwork for this was laid during her tenure of Secretary of State? She does know what she's talking about, etc. Would that have worked for her?
Yeah, she can, except her foreign policy experience counts as something against her at the moment and not for her. But of course, the big risk is that something actually goes wrong in Mosul, and then it's flipped. It's flipped against her. And there are different things that can go wrong. One is that the Shia militias could come in and start massacring people, which would be a real disaster because it would just push all the Sunnis in Mosul onto the side of ISIS. And would destroy the whole object of this operation. And the other is that the Iraqi army, well, we know about the Iraqi army. It's been retrained by the Americans. But frankly, last time they were in Mosul, they dropped their weapons, their very expensive American weapons, and ran for the hills. And, you know, who knows? If they meet big, big resistance, it might happen again, even if it's only a few units. It would be a disaster. It would be a public relations disaster, and not one that would want to be associated with. So I think I think it's just clever. Plus, you know, you've got candidates who don't know what Aleppo is. You know, never mind where it is, but what it is.
Mind you, it is a week till the election, a week from today, at the pace they're going, I doubt very much that it would become something that they'd have to comment on. And Roger's right, of course. When Hillary talks about her record as Secretary of State, the Republicans scream, Benghazi, emails. And before you know it, the conversation has shifted away from Mosul again.
Well, finally tonight, while media outlets across the world are fixated with morbid horror upon the United States, newspapers in Finland are looking closer to home at the annual banquet of gossip that is the revelation of every citizen's tax records. Like Sweden and Norway, Finland makes everyone's tax records available to anyone who can be bothered to look them up. The rationale is that it promotes transparency, encourages equality, and dissuades Donald Trump from running for president. Roger, do we like this idea?
No, I think it's a really stupid idea. I've already got my employer reading my emails. You know, I've got MI5 listening in. And, you know, I really, you know, if there's one thing sacred and private in my life, it's my tax form, and I want to keep it that way. I think it's an abomination of an idea. You know, it takes away your basic, your last basic right of privacy.
Medical records, of course. They're not publishing those yet.
Well, you know how easy it is to get hold of medical records. It's amazingly easy. The more the National Health Service gets digitalized, the easier it is to get.
I mean, Michael, would you sign up for this?
No. My tax affairs are very much my own. I mean, I suppose if you had a very, very basic and simple form, I mean, the Republicans are always like, oh, we should just have a flat tax. We'll simplify the tax code. Donald Trump says, oh, I'd love that. Instead of having, you know, 500 pages of tax returns prepared by batteries of accountants and lawyers that we still can't see because God knows what he's doing in them. You know, we'll just have a flat tax. You earned X, you pay 10%, that's it. Perhaps then, but
imagine how this could be used against immigrants or anything else.
Well, an Italian finance minister did it 1 year and prompted absolute uproar from Italians who are terrified of offering information to kidnappers.
And then there's also just the domestic, and you know, this sound very, very regressive and sexist, but my father always covered up the bottom line where his spouse, my mother, had to co-sign his tax forms.
No.
And is it, darling?
What a cheapskate.
Darling, do you live well? And she said, we live well. I said, do I give you an allowance on the first of the month for household? Or, yes, then you don't need to know how much I earn. And of course, then he went bankrupt when he was 80. he'd been overspending for 50 years.
I mean, Roger, is this one of those? Is this a definitive only in Scandinavia story? Is this the sort of thing that only works in those sort of Scandinavian democracies where, you know, that notion of equality and collegiality is sort of drilled into people from birth?
No, I mean, they have it in Swiss canton or some Swiss cantons as well. I think it's an egalitarian. It's the equivalent of, you know, in Holland when you don't have curtains, yeah, and the glass, your windows are open so that people can see that you're not, you know, you're not having it off with the neighbor's wife and all these kind of things. When I first heard this idea, I thought it's socialist. You know, it's basically the product of an egalitarian society, but it isn't. It's the result of some society that's driven by envy and a kind of crooked version of egalitarianism, and it just doesn't work.
I mean, on the subject of societies driven by envy, Michael, if such a law was instituted in Britain, do you think it would lead to a complete breakdown in social order within 48 hours? I rather suspect that it might.
Oh yeah, 48 minutes. It wouldn't happen. I mean, the premise of your little jest there, Andrew. I just think it's impossible to conceive of Parliament ever allowing this to happen if it was floated up there.
The results would be fairly spectacular, I think, although it would make life a lot easier for possibly our newspapers who least deserve to have their lives made easy. Michael Goldfarb and Roger Boys, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daphne Karnesis. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next at 1900 hours. It's Section D with a special program dedicated to the world of film. More on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. And I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.